From Florida to South Dakota, Maryland to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, cryptocurrency is playing a major role in Ukrainian efforts to defend itself against the Russian invasion. William Luther from the Bitcoin Policy Institute is here to explain how that works. President Biden delivered his first State of the Union address. It was short on initiatives to help Ukraine and long on left-wing talking points. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Can the Environmental Protection Agency force power generators to get to zero net carbon emissions? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Marlo Lewis of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And most colleges and universities required students to get a COVID-19 vaccine to return to in-person learning. Some suffered serious side effects. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says they should now take legal action. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. As Ukrainian freedom fighters engage in a battle to repel Russia's invasion, funds are flowing to them through cryptocurrency markets. William Luther is an assistant professor of economics at Florida Atlantic University and director of the Sound Money Project at the American Institute for Economic Research. He is a fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute. He joins us now to discuss how all of this works. Will, welcome to American Radio Journal. Will, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, these are terms that are being tossed around a lot these days. However, a lot of people have no idea what a Bitcoin is or what cryptocurrency is. So to begin, tell us a bit about this new form of monetary exchange.
Bitcoin is an unbacked digital currency that allows us to make and receive payments on the internet. That's the technical definition there. What that means is that it's an asset, much like the dollar or the yuan, except that it only exists in digital form. So there's no physical coins or cash. And when you make a transaction with Bitcoin, it's processed a bit differently than when you make a transaction with, say, dollars. So, for example, if you're spending cash, that transaction is going to be processed by the two parties involved in the transaction. I hand you cash, and so I don't have the cash, and you have it now. If you swipe your debit card to make a cash payment, well, in that case, you're relying on your bank, which is a trusted third party, to debit your account and credit the recipient's account. But with Bitcoin, it's neither processing transactions like cash or like those debit card transactions. Instead, the entire network of users is running a program that maintains a shared ledger. And that ledger denotes who owns what balance of Bitcoin. And when you make a transaction, that ledger gets updated to debit your account and credit the recipient's account without relying on some trusted third party like a bank or other financial institution.
So removing governments and removing banks from this process, it becomes a little bit like the Wild West here. Ukraine and the invasion that Russia is engaged in of that country, cryptocurrency is playing a fairly substantial role in this. Let's talk first, Will, about Ukraine. How does Bitcoin, how does cryptocurrency assist that country in their efforts to repel this invasion?
Well, Ukraine has been pretty active in the cryptocurrency space for a while now. In 2021, they were ranked fourth globally for Bitcoin adoption, for cryptocurrency adoption. Basically, what they have done is post their receiving address on the internet and announced to the world that they would happily accept support in the form of Bitcoin or Ethereum payments, that is cryptocurrency payments. And the rest of the world has responded. And this morning, when I checked, it looks like they have raised around $36 million in Bitcoin and Ethereum and other cryptocurrency funds. So that's substantial, right? $36 million over the course of a few days in essentially crowdfunding their military efforts.
How does one go about purchasing Bitcoin or even getting into this system?
Well, in the U.S., we have exchanges like Coinbase, where you can go and purchase a balance of Bitcoin. And once you have that balance of Bitcoin, it's very easy to transfer it to someone else's Bitcoin address. You can also just create your own Bitcoin address and accept funds from someone else. And that, in that case, you wouldn't need to go through an exchange. You would just have to find someone willing to give you a Bitcoin or some other cryptocurrency.
We talked about how Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are being used to assist the Ukrainian government, Will, but I would assume that a technology that can be used for good can also be used for evil. So what are the dangers here?
There are certainly a few risks we should keep in mind. For starters, whenever you give someone funds, there's potential for that recipient to use those funds in ways that you don't approve of. Certainly at the moment, I think most of us are very sympathetic to the pain that Ukraine is enduring, and we want to help. But as with any gift, when you send the Ukrainian government a Bitcoin, you lose the right to say what those funds can be spent on. So there's some risk that in the future, perhaps as Ukraine gets pushed further back into a corner, that they will be more inclined to act in ways that perhaps some of those donors would not approve of. So that's certainly a risk, but it's not a risk that's unique to cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. It's just a risk of giving. I think the bigger risk that people are concerned about here is that Russia can use this very same technology in an effort to avoid the sanctions that the U.S. and most other countries have imposed. And certainly there's some scope for that, but I think that the scope for that is much more limited than most people realize. If you're trying to use a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin to avoid sanctions, you're more likely to be successful in doing that if you're dealing with relatively small sums. I mentioned before that all Bitcoin transactions are processed on this shared ledger of blockchain. And that means that anyone can just go look at the Bitcoin blockchain and see what account is sending funds to what other account. And in the U.S. and in many other countries, the exchanges, what we might think of as an off-ramp to the Bitcoin network, they comply with Know Your Customer laws. So if a Russian oligarch were to try to evade sanctions by sending Bitcoin to the U.S. and then cashing out in dollars, it's very easy to catch them at the end of that chain of transactions when they try to cash out in dollars.
We have been talking with William Luther. Will is a fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute, a relatively new entity. Tell us a bit about the Bitcoin Policy Institute, Will, and where can folks go to learn more?
So the Bitcoin Policy Institute is an interdisciplinary cohort of economists, coders, lawyers, climate scientists, philosophers, and policy analysts that provide research, fact-checking, and commentary on Bitcoin. So if you're interested, you can go to btcpolicy.org and find out more.
William Luther of the Bitcoin Policy Institute. Will, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth kept an eye on that State of the Union address the other night. And also, it appears the pandemic is about to be officially over. Scott, we're going to talk about all that. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Joe Biden delivered his first State of the Union address this past week, Scott, and it was somewhat of a mangled hot mess and a lot of boilerplate left-wing talking points. We'd be interested in your thoughts about the highlights or lowlights of the speech.
Yeah, well, obviously, Joe Biden takes the opportunity to annually come before the United States of America and the rest of the world that's watching, and he's got a real opportunity in these moments to deliver some sort of an inspirational motivation speech that, you know, he can kind of maybe bring some unity that he called for back in December of 2020. And here we are, and honestly, I thought that it was quite a divisive speech. President Biden started out highlighting the U.S. position in regards to Ukraine and Russia without really any specific action items to defend the rights of the Ukrainian people. But then when he got going, turned the page off of foreign policy, President Biden went right over to the new Green New Deal, and instead of really talking about the economic impact of the Biden agenda when it comes to inflation, he called for more of the Biden agenda, and that was, I think, a big, big mistake when you think about the economic forecasts that we're going to be dealing with over the next year. Inflation's not going away, and Biden's vision that he presented during his State of the Union was a roadmap to even higher inflation.
Scott, I think a lot of folks, myself included, are preoccupied with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and every night we see the images of destruction. We know that the Russians are hitting hospitals, they're killing women and children. There really wasn't anything new there, and one of the areas where the Biden administration has been attempting to counter Russia with sanctions, has there been any talk? There wasn't in the State of the Union, but is there any talk in Washington about energy policy and shutting off the flow of American dollars to Russia because of our oil imports from that country?
Yeah, there are proposals in the House of Representatives and the United States Senate to stop the United States from purchasing Russian oil. Obviously, this is sort of a self-inflicted harm that we've got on the economy. During President Trump, we had a regulatory policy that allowed for robust energy development here domestically, and we had energy independence. President Biden came in and wants to get us back into the Paris Climate Accord, wants to go even farther with Green New Deal approaches, cancels the Keystone Pipeline, and he's really been basically a puppet to the environmentalist left. So I think that our energy policy is clearly being felt at the not only the gas pump, but also in the jobs market, as a lot of these really, really important positions in the energy industry are going away permanently. And so President Biden has called for, I think, 6 million barrels in the strategic oil reserve, but that's just sort of a Band-Aid on his terrible policy approach when it comes to energy. And we're going to have that reliance on other producers. I think that the Biden administration is trying to lean on some of our allies in the Middle East to produce more oil. But the bottom line is we need deregulation here in the United States that allows for energy independence like we had underneath President Trump.
Another interesting note here at the State of the Union, we saw President Biden, we saw the Vice President and the Speaker of the House behind him. None of them were wearing masks. All of a sudden, has the political science come to the conclusion that this COVID-19 pandemic is over?
Look, I think that President Biden and his cronies in the White House are ready to move on from Fauci. We haven't seen Fauci in a while. And the bottom line is the political science is dictating Democrats are going to get walloped when it comes to the November elections, and President Biden wants to turn the page as quickly as possible in order to mitigate those losses. We know that on Monday, prior to the State of the Union, he was wearing a mask on the South Lawn by himself as he walked over to Marine One, and then on Tuesday, he was maskless, shaking everybody's hands in the House chamber. I think that it's a lot of virtue signaling from the administration. And the bottom line is the Democrats understand politically the American people are ready to move on from masks. We saw what Governor Ron DeSantis said in Florida this week to a group of students at USF that were wearing masks in the backdrop of a speech that he was about to give. He told them they didn't need to wear that and it's time to end the political theatrics. Well, this week we also saw the United States Senate take a vote on sort of an arcane process known as the Congressional Review Act, where they're trying to roll back the CMS vaccine mandate. And we're also seeing a vote in the United States Senate to go ahead and end that COVID national emergency declaration. Because the bottom line is, as long as that emergency declaration exists and is maintained, we cannot turn the page for an economic recovery following these last 2 years. So I think that that's all good progress. We need to see what happens next week in the House of Representatives. And obviously on the vaccine mandates, that's something that President Biden might try to ultimately veto. But I think the American people are fed up with vaccine mandates, fed up with mask mandates, and they're ready to restore their individual freedoms.
Is the process then of officially ending the pandemic, it's one thing for Congress and the president to end the national emergency, but the actual official end of the pandemic and moving into an endemic stage, which sounds like a little bit of bureaucratic needle threading, but actually is very important. Is that something that we would look to the CDC for as opposed to Congress?
I think that it is a declaration that you're going to see out of the executive branch and the agencies. Obviously, Congress can take steps to try to force the administration's hands. Obviously, you've got the purse powers that can dictate policy within the executive branch, but we need to see the leadership within these health agencies take the steps. And, you know, unfortunately, the data might not be there, but the political science is, so we'll see exactly what they decide.
We have been talking here with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure. The Club for Growth is a membership organization based in Washington, D.C. We're united in this idea of economic liberty, freedom, and opportunity. And if anybody out there wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. You can join 525,000 members for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, chat with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency constitutionally able to require a net zero electric power sector by 2035? The case is before the U.S. Supreme Court, and Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Marlo Lewis of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
On Monday of this week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that you may not have heard much about, but it's one that could have major implications for President Joe Biden's agenda, his perhaps stalled agenda to achieve what he says would be a net zero electric power by 2035. That means net zero carbon emissions for all American energy. That case is West Virginia v. the EPA, and that's the case we're going to take a closer look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Marlo Lewis Jr. He is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he follows these energy and environmental issues. He's just written a blog post that you can find at CEI.org about this Supreme Court case, in case you want more of the details that we won't have time to get to here. But Marlo, thank you so much for taking some time with us today.
Great to be with you, Eric.
This case, West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency, this is really a case that gets to sort of the regulatory powers that the EPA has and the limits of them.
That is correct. And it also has wider implications for litigation on almost any administrative agency power, because it implicates what's called the major questions doctrine. And this is a doctrine that is evolving in the Supreme Court and also in other courts. It was very, I think, well summarized by the late Justice Antonin Scalia in another climate policy case called Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA. That was a 2014 case. And it's this doctrine simply says that courts expect Congress to speak clearly when Congress authorizes an agency to make decisions of vast economic and political significance. And the implication of that proposition is that the court will view with skepticism, rather with deference, when an agency claims an unusually expansive power in a long-established statute where this kind of power has never been exercised before. So in other words, it sort of changes the way courts view agency decisions from a deferential standard to a skeptical standard.
Yeah, and this is a major economic issue here, because this is the EPA essentially claiming the authority to impose really huge new costs on producers that are generating electricity and also generating carbon dioxide.
Exactly. The EPA took what is really a backwater or ancillary provision of the Clean Air Act. That's the Supreme Court's term, an ancillary provision. It's Section 111D, which has been used a total of 7 times to address 4 air pollutants from 5 sources since the enactment of this provision, 1970, and none more recently than 1996, until the Obama EPA came along and decided that they could use this ancillary provision in order to restructure electricity markets across the country. So basically what the EPA proposed to do, or what it tried to do in the Clean Power Plan, was set emission standards that were so high that no stationary source could actually meet them. This was a first. This was totally unprecedented. It was an attempt by the Obama EPA to get at all existing fossil fuel power plants, would have put them all out of business, basically. And so the EPA said, oh, but we're not going to put you out of business. You can comply by basically ceding market share to your competitors. So if you're a coal plant, you can cede market share to a natural gas generating facility, or if you're a gas generator or a coal plant, you can cede market share to renewable power stations.
We're talking with Marlo Lewis. He is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, talking about a case that the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this week, West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency. As you were just saying, Marlo, this has to do with the Clean Power Plan, the Obama-era Clean Power Plan, which, as you write in your post at CEI.org about this, was really an attempt to squeeze coal power plants out of the electricity marketplace. And that's what the Supreme Court is looking at today. We've got just about a minute or so left here, but quickly, is there any indication from oral arguments which way the court might be leaning on this, or do you care to speculate about where things might end up here?
I really can't speculate. It's really tough to read the tea leaves from oral argument, but I will say that the Biden administration EPA has a tough road, or an uphill road, because if anyone bothers to read Section 111, you won't find Congress speaking clearly at all about the issue of carbon dioxide emissions or climate change. And there's certainly no visible authority in it for the EPA to become kind of an industrial policy czar whose mission is to restructure vast portions of the U.S. economy for climate change purposes or any other purpose.
Sorry. I think the point that you make about the major powers doctrine is this is really an important one, and one that I know most people probably are not paying a ton of attention to, but the courts here, I think, an opportunity for them to really speak clearly about this, that like the environmental agency or any agency, regulatory agencies in general, sort of taking one small thing like they did here and saying, oh, because of this power that was granted to us decades ago, we can now take this expansive new power to regulate whatever it might be. That's obviously a significant, a major issue, and one that you guys at CEI do a great job of tracking and keeping an eye on and raising awareness about. So appreciate your time here today, Mark.
Thank you very much, Eric.
Again, that's Marlo Lewis. He's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Check out their work online at CEI.org. Fantastic stuff there. And again, you can find more about this there at CEI.org. You can check out our coverage of everything going on in Washington, D.C. and around the country at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Colleges and universities forced COVID-19 vaccines on their students, and some suffered serious side effects. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says they should now take legal action.
The NCAA is finally on the ball. Its COVID-19 medical advisory group has adjusted its definition of fully vaccinated to account not only for vaccinations and boosters, but other immunity factors such as natural immunity, i.e. real immunity. Individual athletes with documented COVID-19 infection within 90 days now carry the equivalent of fully vaccinated, and it's about time. Also considered fully vaccinated are athletes within 5 months of having received the Pfizer and Moderna mRNA vaccines, as well as those within only 2 months of receiving the Johnson & Johnson shot. Yes, a mere 2 months. Once again, we see the embarrassing inefficacy of the J&J jab. Though I said it's about time, it's actually far too late for many collegians. And even then, the decision is questionable at other levels. For starters, nearly every major study has shown the superiority of natural immunity over artificial immunity. The NCAA does not have data to know with certainty that Pfizer and Moderna are better, especially in responding to the Omicron variant. Omicron is clearly affecting the vaccinated as well as the unvaccinated. In fact, I find the NCAA's evolving definition dubious. In reality, many, if not perhaps most, student-athletes with a positive COVID infection over the last 90 days have already been vaccinated, forcibly so. Their university demanded it as a requirement for readmission in late August of last year. And yet, many ended up getting COVID anyway, because the efficacy of all three major vaccines drops like a rock after several months. The NCAA's new definition is also capricious. Consider, how does the NCAA know that natural immunity gives a student athlete only 90 days of immunity? Where did NCAA officials conjure up that? This begs another question. If the NCAA is adjusting its guidelines for athletes, why aren't colleges doing the same for all students? The NCAA's policy should be general policy, athlete, non-athlete. Worst of all, the NCAA's sudden shift honoring natural immunity is actually an indictment of the reckless vaccine mandates imposed by universities in the fall of 2021, and they should not be let off the hook for that. The NCAA's action comes 5 months after countless universities forced young adults to be injected with experimental drugs that many neither desired nor needed, especially those with natural immunity. Many of the victims pleaded their case to university officials and even judges with formal medical appeals from their physicians, and yet their colleges rejected them, threatening to expel them, and in many cases, carrying through on that expulsion. Many of the students, athletes among them, experienced precisely the deleterious side effects they feared and warned their university officials about, including myocarditis and pericarditis. I personally know of a 19-year-old girl who, shortly after receiving the shot, had such severe heart failure that she required a heart transplant and now actually even awaits a kidney transplant. Yes, seriously. Many of the students who appealed forced vaccination did so on the basis of their natural immunity, and the universities in turn flatly rejected those appeals. Now, in effect, the NCAA has said that those students were right. The universities didn't listen, and their refusal caused harm. This was unjustified and a grave injustice. Only now, after countless young adults who survived COVID were forcibly vaxxed against their will and unnecessarily, is the NCAA doing the right thing and bucking the CDC's and Anthony Fauci's uncompromisingly irrational policy of 100% mass vaccination of all Americans without exception. For many, if not most, it's too late. Those students who have been harmed should now seek legal action. If your child was hospitalized after a college forced him or her to be injected with vaccines, despite already having had and survived COVID with natural immunity, and despite your medical and conscience appeals, you need to contact a lawyer. Your family lawyer needs to be contacting that university now. Do not hesitate. They had no right to deny your rights. They must now be held accountable. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBBC-FM, WKLV-AM and FM in Blackstone, Virginia, along with KXBR-FM in International Falls, Minnesota. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.